In his smuggling days, Davos had often jested that he knew the waterfront at King's Landing a deal better than the back of his hand, since he had not spent a good part of his life sneaking in and out of the back of his hand. The squat towers of new raw stone that stood opposite one another at the mouth of the Blackwater might mean nothing to Sir Emily Florent, but to him it was as if two extra fingers had sprouted from his knuckles. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, your source for Game of Thrones, the living card game content, formerly known as Two Champs and a Chump. We rebranded for the second edition. I want to give a huge thank you to George R. R. Martin, FFG, and to you, our fans, especially those of you that support us on Patreon. I don't do that enough. We've got big news. I want to make sure it's always in front of people this whole summer. We're hosting nationals in Springfield, Missouri again. This year, they're known as the Grand Championships. We've rented a castle. There's Lord of the Rings. There's board games. There's going to be so much more. Head on over to www.conflictatthecastle.com to find out more.
Definitely was one of the better quotes that we've had recently while I've been on.
Yeah, exactly. We'll take that how it was. I wanted to find something Blackwater related, but you know, the Blackwater is actually mentioned quite a bit in the books. I'm not sure I had enough time to really go through all of them.
So,
but I thought that was amusing at the very least.
Yeah. It was a classic Martin. One of the weird tics, and this is why we really will miss Luke, like one of Martin's weird tics is taking contemporary phrases that definitely have no basis anywhere near medieval society and then like turning them into like a moment of meditation for his character. So we have like back of the hand, nipples on a breastplate, like all of these things. It's a very interesting Martin tic in his writing. So this is a great example of it.
Yeah. Ooh, sorry, desperately trying not to sneeze on air here. That seems like it would not be good at all, right?
Probably not.
That's Scott, who's now back on the East Coast circuit up here.
So are we calling this Essos? Did we decide, Will?
You know, I don't know if we ever actually settled on new team names. So, I mean,
Essos and Westeros makes the most sense. I mean, it does. You are west of us. We are east of you. So it all makes
sense.
Sounds
like a deal to me.
But, yep. So I'm Roy.
Roy already introduced me.
Oh, well, okay. That's fair. I was waiting on Scott to introduce himself, but it had already been done. So in that case, I'm Will.
And we don't have Glazer with us this week. He's too busy being a good husband in South America to join us.
There we go. He is out of the country. So hope he has a good time and safe travels back and forth.
Period.
They still have internet in Colombia. He's being a bad co-host.
Ooh. You know, that's true. He didn't even offer to try and arrange something while he was out of the nation.
I don't think he brought his computer with him.
I'm kidding. It's totally fine, Aaron.
I like how Scott says this like Aaron's going to ever hear it.
I assume. There, like, of all, to be fair, it's a review episode, so there's like a 5% chance that Glazer will listen to it. Like, there's still a 95% chance he won't. So, like, the safe money is on him not doing it. But because we're talking about cards, Glazer's favorite thing to do, there's a chance. There's
is to tell us that we were wrong about one of them.
Yes, but that's what Second Sons is for, Will. For him to tell us all, you know, to backseat review for us. But
brilliant. Well, I'm glad to be providing you some topics for one of your upcoming episodes.
Oh, I'm sure. We never run out of topics on Second Son, so. We ready to do this?
Yeah, I think so. Let's hop in. We've got the Blackwater here in front of us.
So, do you want me to real quick go over our rating scale for if at this point no one has, you know, not listened to one of our review episodes, Will?
You know, I am sure there's bound to be some new listeners every episode, so you should probably do it.
All right, so the baseline of our grading system is the American school system. A, B, C, D, and F. A are the best cards, the meta-defining cards, the cards that change the game the moment they're printed. You can think of them as, let's see, what's an example? Maybe Mira Reed is even on the top end of that. But very powerful cards immediately make you rethink the meta, rethink decks. Just below that are B cards. These are pretty good cards. They can be strong. Maybe they're, you know, an A card is an all-around card that just goes in all Stark decks, all Greyjoy decks, all Targaryen decks. B cards maybe don't go in every Stark deck, but they can go in some, and they're powerful and useful in those decks. And, you know, they're somewhat role players. They're sort of the grist of a deck that really makes it work. Then we have C cards. These are firmly medium cards. They're replacement level cards. They're cards that, you know, have very narrow places where they're extremely powerful. Otherwise, they're just sort of there. You need to come get your deck to 60 cards, and this is going to be your, you know, 59th, 60th, or even 61st card because you just need to fill the deck out. You need to fill the theme. That brings us to D. These are, of course, the lowest tier of playable cards. They have extremely narrow implications. We're talking about, like, very rare silver of silver bullets for, you know, for super werewolves, right? Or whatever you need to do. And then, of course, there are Fs. These cards should not be in your deck. They are bad. They are trap cards. Do not play them. You know, you might as well just throw them in the garbage can and you know, or use them for proxies. There are two sort of special ratings that we give. There is the James Wamsley Memorial E rating, which is for cards that are build arounds that are really difficult to sort of put in our traditional grading scale. It's a punt of a review, but it's basically saying that, you know, this card is extremely powerful, but it may not have any implications right now. A great example of this is Brandon's Gift when it was printed in the first cycle. Utterly useless card when it was first printed. Now one of the most powerful cards in the card pool. Example. And then, of course, there's S. S, these cards are busted, should not have been printed. Above and beyond amazing, just utterly, they're not even just really good cards like A's are. They utterly warp the meta around them. Examples of this, of course, are Wars to Come, Vince, which is Drowned Ground Fanatic, Flea Bottom. These are just cards that are just so above and beyond anything else that they just are amazing. So that is our rating.
Sounds good. You know, I never thought about this till just now, but it's now my official headcanon that the S tier actually stands for should not have been printed. So there we go.
There we go. It's definitely not stolen from JRPGs.
Yeah, oh, definitely not.
It's definitely from that. Definitely find that. Anyway.
Yeah.
So who wants to do Stark?
You're the one who's played the most Stark, Roy.
Am I? That's kind of really
definitely
sad.
Definitely more than I have.
Definitely more. Well, I played like the Hollow Hill Stark, I guess.
All right. Well, maybe this card goes in the Hollow Hill Stark. Who knows? First card that we have today is Small Folk Mob. It has a military icon and a power icon, 4 strength, 9 unique, non-loyal. It is an ally. Shadow 4. Action. Sacrifice a unique Stark character to put Small Folk Mob into play from Shadows. So this is Stark's part of the cycle of cards that's sort of free Shadows cards. And then another part of a cycle that Stark gets here is Shadow of the North, which is a null cost loyal Stark event. Shadow 1, play only during a challenge. Action, raise the claim value on your reveal plot card by 1 until the end of the challenge. If there's a winter plot card revealed, return Shadow of the North to your hand instead of placing it in your discard pile. I think that these are both really interesting cards. I think we'll start with sort of Small Folk Mob, because I think it's the easier one to rate. I think Small Folk Mob right now is not going to see a lot of play because Stark midrange is just really bad. And there's just better sack outlets in the form of Skagos and Wyman. But should Skagos get restricted and Stark is looking for an additional sack outlet, you know, to supplement Wyman or to supplement Skagos, if Skagos is the restricted card, this is a card they would definitely go to, because it's definitely fair for what what Stark wants to do. And of course, a 4/4 body is very solid with the cost of sacrificing a unique Stark character. And there are plenty of unique Stark characters that you don't mind sacrificing, you know, Rickons, Sansas, Brands, you know, the kind of cards you can get back, Mira's even, the kind of cards that you can get back from with Summer, or as a form of attachment control, right? Your Fast Eddie has Hantios Accent on it. You draw the dupe. You bring Small Folk Mob out, clear the Hantios Accent away, and you have a new Eddard. So right now, this card might not see a lot of play, but it's pretty good if better cards get restricted. And then I think Shadow of the North is hard to evaluate because Stark aggro is in a terrible place right now. It's just no one like you don't see Winter is Coming being played very often. And that's a cheaper version of this. Of course, you can't recycle it the way you can recycle Shadow of the North. But of course, you're paying 3 gold for a recyclable Winter is Coming. I think that this won't see very much play because there's nothing really pushing you towards that hyper aggro Stark. So I'm going to give Stark an E rating overall in this pack. Just on the strength that I think Small Folk Mob, when Skagos inevitably gets restricted, will see some play. And Shadow of the North has potential to be good. But again, the current meta doesn't really give me a reason to want to play these cards.
Interesting. I think you're right. The Small Folk Mob is just outclassed by other similar sacrifice outlets, not only in the unique restriction here, which I think is actually fairly limiting, but the fact that it's only one trigger versus things like Skagos and Wyman being able to be triggered repeatedly over and over as the turns go by. But I think there could be room for Shadow. Like, as you said, Stark aggro hasn't really been around right now, and this is a little expensive, but it's repeatable and it's stackable with Winter is Coming. So
that's fair.
I think there's something to be said here that a Stark aggro deck could have the potential to get up to those early turn high claim shenanigans in a similar way to, say, Free Folk, but without the restriction to only neutral cards. So I think there might be something to play around with here. I'm interested to explore it.
I just think it's an E like Roy. I think fully Winter Plot deck hasn't ever fully worked since about the time that the agenda got released. And only then, like, Dan Struhal got it to work. Not many people really got it to work. And 3 gold is a lot, especially in a deck that's running winter plots, which will have less gold to deal with. So, I mean, I hope in some way I'm wrong, so there will be some more interesting Stark builds, in some ways at least, because Stark is probably the second best house, but is still the same type of thing over and over. Right? Skagos is just too busted and does need to get restricted, as we're hinted to. But I don't think the build exists very easily in my mind, at least.
It's an interesting comparison to Free Folk for Shadow of the North, right? One of the what I think makes where Free Folk aggro comes in is just that the agenda is busted. And the agenda, there's a massive opportunity cost that you get from not playing any good cards. You're stuck playing a bunch of two good neutral cards and a bunch of garbage. But the agenda is just so busted. And there is no, in the actual game, there's no opportunity cost to using the agenda. It doesn't require gold. It just requires a challenge win. Again, it has that every turn. So it gives you a lot of flexibility once you come to terms with the fact that you're playing mostly garbage in your deck. Shadow of the North, that 3 gold is a huge opportunity cost. Maybe if you set it up, and so you can get a really powerful first turn off, but if that first turn doesn't blow your opponent out, which, maybe it will because you open the 2-claim winter plot and so you got a 3-claim thing. But if it doesn't, then you're in trouble. Because you are going to have to pay 3 gold to get this effect again. And your opponent knows it's coming. And if they're running any incidental anti-shadows tech, it gets hit by that. So while I do think it's definitely the kind of card that you'll lose to on the Iron Throne and be like, oh man, that's busted. And then you try it yourself and you're like, this sucks. It's not otherwise going to see a lot of play. But I could be wrong. I'm frequently am.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. I think that's one that could come around. It's maybe an E for that out, but we'll see.
You want to do the Tyrell cards, buddy?
Sure. At least I assume it was to me.
Yeah.
My bad if it was meant to be for Scott.
No. Well, Scott will get the Martell cards since Glazer's not here, or the Night's Watch cards actually. So he likes.
Yeah, he was just talking about that. All right, Tyrell it is. First up, we have Highgarden Jester. This is a non-loyal, non-unique character. 2 cost, 1 strength, a power icon. It's an ally and a fool. It has insight and forced reaction after Highgarden Jester draws a card using insight. Place a random card from your hand on top of your deck. Choose a card from your hand and place it on top of your deck instead if there's another fool character in play. And Shadow of the Rose. This is a loyal Shadows event. No gold cost. Shadow 2. And action, reveal the top 10 cards of your deck for a card with Shadow. Reveal it, put it into Shadows. Shuffle your deck. There's a summer plot card revealed. Return Shadow of the Rose to your hand instead of placing it in your discard pile. Wow, I am so torn here on Tyrell and a rating on a house as a whole because Highgarden Jester is terrible. It's an F card. Let's just get that out there. I don't think there's any reason to ever play this in Tyrell when you have a plethora of other draw options and ones that actually net you card advantage. Even in the best case scenario, this one is just kind of a wonky filter. Shadow of the Rose, on the other hand, I think is a great event for some kind of Kingdom of Shadows deck. I think digging down in there to find something and drop it straight into Shadows, you're not quite getting an econ boost since this costs Shadow 2 itself, but at least you're not paying extra to just have to put the card into Shadows afterward. I think this is really cool, and maybe almost more what Tyrell needed to pull Kingdom of Shadows together out of their house. Why is my mind blanking now on the attachment that returns things to Shadows?
Unexpected Guile?
Yeah,
there we go. It's so busted. So busted.
It's but a good card.
I love this
their location's good too.
I love the old town Undercity. Love that card.
That card is extremely powerful.
Tyrell Shadows deck can just churn through cards.
Really,
exactly what they
prize to hear you say, Will, that you don't think Tyrell Shadows has come together, because I definitely think it has. And I don't necessarily think that Shadow of the Rose will go in that deck, because that deck can't.
Kingdom of Shadows or Assault?
No, Kingdom of Shadows.
Okay, I think the Kingdom of Shadows
deck is one of, I think it and Lannister, and I think Lannister got much better cards, so maybe Lannister now is above it. The new Tyrion is quite interesting and quite powerful. Shadow of the Rose is, I don't see a Tyrell Kingdom deck playing it because it doesn't impact the board, right? And the key thing to Shadows decks is you want to play all the Shadows cards that impact the board. If you're just like, that deck does enough spinning its wheels to, that it doesn't need additional spinning its wheels. Like, and it has card advantage engines in the form of Old Town Undercity.
And this does give you an extra Undercity trigger, of course.
I mean, it does, but like, I've never suffered from getting at least one Undercity trigger around, if not two, depending on how aggressive I'm being. I think that one of the traps in Shadows decks is running some of these, like, again, churning your wheels, you know, kind of cards, because you have to be impacting the board. Because there's so much, there's like a legitimately huge amount of anti-Shadows hate out there. With Barring and King Plot, like every action you take, every piece of tempo that you sacrifice and give up could potentially bite you in the butt when they do their Barring turn or their King Plot turn. To me, Shadow of the Rose will never be played honest. Like, I think the Shadows version you described there is an honest way to play this card. I think this is a combo card. The fact that it gets Growing Ambition is busted. you can find some way to get a ton of gold with a summer plot, or even without a summer plot, and putting this in there like on a meddling turn where this is free and you put a gold Growing Ambition in, and sure, they'll end up having to give you a Shadow of the Rose, but if you grow it, you do this, then you get a trigger with your Citadel Archivist, clear your discard pile, and then bring your, like, there's just so many broken things in that deck you could do a Shadow of the Rose. So I don't think that this card is ever going to be played honest. I think it goes in just any deck that is trying to abuse the Tyrell combo shell. Highgarden Jester is cool in the sense that it, like, is non-loyal draw, but it is, as you said, an F card. So I was going to give this like a C, just simply on the fact that Shadow of the Rose is so busted in combo and has that like honest application that you said, Will. But I think Shadow of the Rose is definitely, you know, Sandy Barnabas woke up feeling good this morning when he saw this card spoiled. Scotty?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Roy on this one. It doesn't make me happy, but I do. I think the 2 gold disadvantage you're getting by playing Shadow of the Rose in an honest deck is probably too much. It's taking up the card slot and -2 gold, that's a lot, right? As far as combo, you just want to get the pieces, and especially if you can do it on a meddling turn, it'll even help get the pieces. I don't think this is the best combo card, because it is kind of expensive, but if it'll get you the pieces and you could just win, then just win. So, I guess Shadow of the Rose gets an E. You don't build around it, but it's part of a build around package. And Jester gets an F. So you can make that C minus C area, I suppose.
I don't think you gave it a rating, Will, because I went on my rant about Shadow.
Oh. Oh, gotcha. Well, like I said, I'm having a hard time with the split between the two. I think due to having to average that out between them, it probably comes out to like a C+ or something. But yeah, I feel very kind of pulled to the extremes for each of those cards.
Cool.
Okay. So Night's Watch, we have Yorin. Unique, loyal character, 6 cost, military and intrigue traits, 3 strength, reaction. After Yorin enters play, choose a character with printed cost 5 or lower. Take control of that character until Yorin leaves play. And 2, yeah, he's pretty strong. And then we have another Night's Watch loyal card, 2 cost event, Bound for the Wall. Reaction, after you win a challenge, as the attacking player reveal the top 5 cards of a losing opponent's deck, you may put a character reveal this way into play under your control. Place the other reveal cards at the bottom of the deck in random order. Max 1 per challenge. So these are obviously both extremely strong cards. Both don't seem very fair. But I think they see play in very different type of decks. So Yorin sees play in a more attrition. I want to be able to march things and bring your board down, more like a Night's Watch Wolf traditional way we'd view it, right? If you're playing big wall, maybe you play this, but you might also play Core Yorin because things are getting in the discard in that deck. But obviously super strong. 6 cost can be a little expensive for this type of decks, but you obviously take that for sort of effect. And Bound for the Wall is just RNG generator, which is not good for the game and not good for strategy and, you know, play being based upon the best player, but incredibly strong. You will just win games off this and just lose games off this, right? But I think it's a 3 of an any semi-offensive Night's Watch deck from here till the end of time, because as long as big guys are still a thing, being able to just take a big guy is pretty damn strong, and it doesn't have to be non-unique, which is also pretty crazy.
Busted.
Yo.
I'm amazed that's the only targeting restriction.
The only targeting restriction is top 5. So I guess you have to give this the S rating, right? Because the 2 ways to play Night's Watch, this is
non-defense.
Yeah, non-defense. But the defense, I think, died. Besides Builders.
Well, yeah, Builders is defense, right?
Well.
So.
Yeah.
Still, besides that, I think you have to give this an S. These are potentially even meta impacting. I mean, hopefully the side effect of Bound for the Wall, even though I hate it, will be less 3 of Euron, 3 of Balon, 3 of Asha, 3 of Wyman, etc. But one can only...
You say that, Scotty, and I know you wish that truly in your heart, but it's not going to happen. What I think Bound for the Wall does is it does hopefully, finally, create enough redundancy of effects like this for the deck to be, for the big wall strategy deck to be consistent. You know, big wall has constantly threatening to be good. You know, it generally, you know, it tore up a little bit in the middle of this past year, but it also is just a high variance deck. And Bound for the Wall is also a high variance card, but it's, you know, miss opportunity is pretty low, because, you know, at the worst you're paying 2 cost to get a character. Like, it could be a crap, one of your opponent's crappy characters, but at least you are most of the time
you can
improving
miss.
Your board state. You can miss, and it's top 5, so it's easier. But I mean, I'm not a math expert. I'm sure somebody will, like the Trays of the world, will do the math. But I would say it's more likely to hit something than not, right? That's a fair thing to say.
I mean, because it can take any character, so it's not even a subset of characters in the deck. And what, most decks are running 30 to 35?
So everyone except Roy Rogers is going to always hit. I will, of course, miss all the time. It always happens. You know, I notoriously miss all the time with my air triggers. Heir to the Iron Throne, which is a similar effect to this, but it goes 10 card deep. But it's a super strong. It just creates additional redundancy with Queen's Crown and the two cost recyclable event that Night's Watch has. Guarding the Realm, I think, is the name of it. With Big Wall, like there's just all and then this and both Yorins. There's now just enough consistency and that you can just constantly be hitting your opponent and stealing their toys, stealing their milkshake all the time. And that's what I think makes it S tier. Yorin is extremely powerful and hilarious.
I mean, if you're like, the one playing,
And one of the things, having played a lot of Robert Strong recently, there's an impressive number of characters that are printed five cost or lower. And that, you know, tempo hit of Robert Stronging them is really strong, but it, stealing them and putting them back on, putting them on your side, is amazing. It's also an enters play trigger, which is really interesting. If you have ways to cheat him into play, you get that trigger in the middle of the challenge phase. There's not a huge number of ways for Night's Watch to do that, but it's definitely something to keep in mind.
Night's Watch son, carry on.
Yeah.
He's six, not five.
You play him, I was thinking about you five, take possibly. Someone, you march that someone to the wall, then you cold hands him.
Cold hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kill cold hands, yeah. Get Yorin. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would not be surprised that there are things like that. Or you steal something kind of garbagey, then, you know, do what you need to do. Cold hands, Yorin, they get their garbagey thing back. Your cold hands leaves play. You get Yorin, you get to steal a better thing. Like, there's a lot of play with this card that people will find really obnoxious. but that separates him from the core Yorin, right, who is a martial trigger. So that's something to keep in mind. I definitely agree with Scott. These are S-tier cards. These are the cards that Night's Watch Attrition, which has had a pretty good year, but an inconsistent year, right? The Rat Cook deck has done well. The Big Wall deck has done pretty well too, but not like hasn't made a big splash. And I think that these are the cards that will make them really have a splash. And I'm excited to do this. I'm excited to watch my friends Bound for the Wall people and win games. And I am ready for my salty tears when I Bound for the Wall someone and it's five events on the top of the deck. Well, or three events in two locations.
Then they could core Yorin, take something from the grave for three, and then Skagos and Big Yorin, something from the board.
That would be amazing. But sadly, we don't have that. I guess we're on to the bear cards.
I didn't rate them. Well, I didn't rate them.
Will.
I agree that these are bonkers. Really good. This Yorin feels really huge to me with some of those type of plays that we're talking about. So I definitely agree that Night's Watch gets an S this time around. Okay, now we can go.
All right, Suppressing Greenfield Field, excuse me. He is a Shadow 5 Military Intrigue 4 Strength unique non-loyal Kingsguard and Knight character with Shadow 4. Reaction. After you win a challenge in which Suppressing Greenfield is participating, the losing opponent must move one power from his or her faction card to a standing character he or she controls. And then we have a unique Shadow 3 cost location, Blackwater Rush. It has the Westeros trait. Reaction, after a card you control comes out of Shadows, Neil Blackwater Rush to choose a Barak character. That character gains one power. I think Blackwater Rush, Black Cells and Blackwater Rush, I think push Barra now firmly into a Kingdom of Shadows build that it wasn't necessarily at before this. Because, Black Cells is really strong, but I don't think it's as straight up busted as the Lannister and Tyrell cards. Because it provides some good action advantage, but not that repeated card advantage and money in the sense of the Lannister card. But now that they have the second effect that provides a passive power, and I cannot tell you, as someone who's played a lot of Shadows decks, decks are really slow. This acceleration gives Barra an edge in the Shadow's Mirror that I think is really important and really powerful. Of course, there's not that many great Barra Shadows cards. So, you know, you're going to have to, I think, stretch a little bit. But I definitely think this makes Barra a real player in the Shadows build. And it'll be interesting. And a more traditional Shadows build than the one that, say, Wassa brought to Gen Con. I need some Galaxy Brain person to explain to me why you would play Preston Greenfield. He definitely does not seem all that great to me. Like,
wait till you see the agenda in this pack, then you'll understand.
You're being you're being even more generous than I would have. I mean, he does, I suppose, combo with Box Melisandre,
which is weird.
But for the most, flavor wise, that doesn't make any sense. And for the most part, he does the exact opposite of what Baratheon wants to do with most of their things.
I mean, so Barra has this theme of moving power around, right? And so theoretically, you know, you move a power off their faction card onto a character, you kill that character, and that power's gone, right? But a standing character he or she controls, so it doesn't even synergize with Robert Strong. Like,
yeah. Or the rest of Baratheon's deal theme.
I honest to goodness do not understand this card. Like, I do not get it. And I'm sure there's somebody who...
It doesn't synergize with other Kingsguard either, for that matter. I guess... No, I was about to say Kingsguard Jaime.
He has an intrigue
icon. Not even that, because Preston already has...
But he would get Renown, right? Because it's Renown and intrigue icon, right? When they're attacking alone. But yeah. It's... Yeah. So I give this a C. Because Preston Greenfield is an F to me. He's like, why would you pay 6 gold in a Shadows deck for this effect? Like, that's an, but I can't understand it. But Blackwater Rush is a good card. So overall, I'd say this averages out to about a C, B minus E, if you're being like, because Blackwater Rush, again, giving acceleration to Barra Shadows is great. So.
I want to like it, but I think I'm probably sitting at more like C minus for Baratheon, because I think that caveat right there on Blackwater Rush has a problem that you kind of hinted at but didn't delve into, because the power has to go on a Baratheon character. And so you mentioned that Baratheon doesn't really have like a great stable of Shadows characters themselves, which means you're pushed into probably looking at Kingdom of Shadows, which now means you're being taxed for playing, you know, traditionally marshaled characters, plus you're eating up slots for the out of house Shadow stuff you want to include with Kingdom. So I feel like it's a real fine line there with Blackwater Rush. I'm not sure that it's going to play out, that all those items line up for Rush to be what we want it to be.
Well, I mean, it might push Barra towards Barra Assault. The annoying interaction that Wassa's found, where you can permanently put cards in Shadows and they can never leave, still exists in that. So, I don't know. Scotty, what do you think?
I tend to agree more with Will on this one. I also think, in general, Shadows decks don't, their boards aren't sticky, right? They generally come in and out of the board. So you're also depending on having a Stormlands fiefdom then. So when you do get power on that character, you're able to get on your faction card. Because if you're, at least in Kingdom, you are bringing things in and out of the board because you're basically controlling the board presence. And then by doing that, you're not keeping the characters that have the power on them on the board. And that kind of defeats the purpose of this card. Preston Greenfield is just bad, so he'll get a D minus or an F or something. And Blackwater Russia C minus. You'll play it if you're in Barra Kingdom of Shadows, but you're playing that more to be able to keep things knelt with the black cells, not as much for this Blackwater Rush, which just isn't enough good barrier cards you're going to play in that deck, unfortunately. So I'll give it a C minus in the case that someone figures out Blackwater Rush, and maybe the Assault deck maybe will be good. The interaction is good. There are better Barra Shadows non-character cards. So maybe it'll be a thing. But I'm still skeptical, especially when Lenny and Tyrell have as many Shadows things as they do.
Will, give us your other favorite faction.
Yeah. We have Tyrion Lannister. He is a unique, loyal Lannister character. 6 cost, 5 strength, power and intrigue icons, lord and small council traits, shadow 5, and insight. And reaction, after a non-event card you control comes out of shadows, place another card you control in shadows with a shadow token on it. While that card is in shadows, it gains shadow X. X is its printed cost. Limit once per round. And then we have a very large shadow. This is a Lannister loyal event. No cost, shadow 0. And action, reduce the cost of the next card you bring out of shadows phase by 3. If there is a scheme plot card revealed, return a very large shadow to your hand instead of placing it in your discard pile. Max 1 per phase. I'm going to start with a very large shadow because I just don't quite feel this is there. Since it costs 2 to put into shadows, you're only netting 1 whenever you bring this out. So, you know, unless you're really desperately just needing to move gold from one phase to another, I just don't think it's enough. Plus, scheme plots are not heavily played the way they used to be. Reigns of Castamere is not the agenda it once was. So I just don't think this is going to be an event I ever play. Tyrion, on the other hand, I think is phenomenal. We thought the big new Shadow Cersei we got was the kind of a centerpiece character for Lannister Shadows. But now I think we realize it might be Tyrion. The amount of shenanigans that you can pull off by being able to immediately put something back into shadows is just phenomenal. I mean, I already think that that's a huge part of where the strength of Lannister Shadows as a deck is right now, based on Clever Feint and the ability to put things back so that you can keep reusing your Mandans, your Sir Robert Strongs, your Shadow Priestess, and so on. And Tyrion is just that on a stick. Plus, he doesn't even have to put stuff that has shadows to start with back into shadows, which lets you do some very interesting things, putting other cards back into shadows. I saw some musings on Facebook earlier today about, for instance, doing that with Vanguard Lancer, so that you can keep popping them in and out and knocking power off. So that's going to be fun to put up with at some point. But I think, arguably, maybe even on top of that, the thing I'm most excited about is the fact that he has insight. Draw in Lannister. It's been so long. He's up against stiff competition in Corset Tyrion still, and certainly is not going to see play in just your run-of-the-mill deck versus his core brethren, but in a Shadows deck, I think this is going to be awesome. And a rating, sorry. I'm going to give Lannister out of this probably a B to... let's go B plus. Very large shadow is definitely pulling me down here.
Well, we'll start with Tyrion. So I think Tyrion's a really interesting card. I think he's here's where I disagree with you, Will. I think that he's actually more of a Lannister good stuff card than you give him credit for. Because it has to do with insight. The fact that he's draw, the fact that he's a 5-strength draw card. So that means, you know, if your opponent wants to burn him, they really have to put the effort in. If they want, he can't be Robert Stronged. It's, you know, more difficult for him to be returned to hand. Just, you know, the 6-for-5 spot is usually pretty good for a challenge based character, right? As we've learned for like Wyman, Khorob, 6-for-5 is generally Khal Drogo. These are generally like relatively safe spots for impactful characters and challenges. And the ability to draw a card is really good, particularly in a faction that's really thirsty for card draw. So I actually think this might be the version of Tyrion that honestly competes with the 5-drop. So the question is, do you want the stealth plus the economy, or do you want this really interesting ability, which he can also put himself into shadows, if I read this correctly, right?
Oh, gosh. Let me go.
After a non-event card, you control comes in out of shadows, plays another, so that says a different card than the one that came out of shadows, right?
Yeah, it could be.
So he can put himself into shadows if he needs to protect himself. Like, he's just a very flexible card in that way. So a Lannister good stuff deck that has a soft shadows theme could definitely be here. A Lannister assault deck, could also be good in. And of course, it is good in Kingdom of Shadows. He's great with his sister and those kind of things. So I actually think he's like an A-B+ card. So I've actually a very large shot. I'm actually interested to see what Scott has to say about this card. But for me, the way I like to think about this is, would you pay for a one-off his dart trigger for 2 gold? I think theoretically, yes. But the problem is Lannister Shadows, particularly Kingdom of Shadows decks, are the slots are tight. The slots are extremely, extremely tight. And I don't know if you have room for a very large shadow. So I don't think this card is bad. I think it's definitely better than the Tyrell one we talked about earlier, because it does give you at least a +1 gold advantage. Actually, the card that this most compares with to me is the Tyrell event, the one that you pay 2, you gain 5.
But that's a boost of 3. Like this is a boost of 1.
Yeah. It's a boost of 3, but this also gives you a shadows trigger, right? So it has a different form of utility, right? But I think it compares to Hisdar, and I think it compares to that Tyrell event. It's neither as good as either of those cards, but I think it sits pretty interestingly. I don't think it will make the cut simply because, like, what are you cutting from your Lannister Shadows decks? You're definitely cutting some cards to make room for Tyrion, but I don't know what you're cutting to make room for this. So I would give Lannister a B- there, but I'm really excited. I think I wouldn't be surprised if we see a very large shadow as like a one of maybe in some Lannister Shadow cards. You think it's a bad card?
Oh,
I don't think it's a bad card. I do not. I don't think the deck's there for it, but I don't think it's a bad card. So I think you're looking at it as if it was during the same round, right?
Do what during the same round?
But that's not the
a very large shadow. Only netting 2, and then
you're only netting 1 in the same.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Which is true. You might be able to, or you might sometimes want to shift gold from one round to another, which it does allow for, but
This is a post valor card,
right? You put this in the shadows on your trade routes turn and bring it out on your valor turn, right? Is powerful,
so you can do it that way. If you are running a lot of schemes, which if any faction is going to do it, it will be Lannister. It does have the repeat, but I think that is less likely. But I do think if you are running a heavy board reset kind of deck, which I don't think it's there yet, but Lannister might be on the cusp of doing right with, you know, Mandon Moore coming in out of shadows, Robert Strong coming in and out of shadows, these type of things that'll help clear the opponent's board a bit. Then if they get a bit high, you Valor. But if they don't, and you have a turn where you can kind of build your board a bit for a turn that they might try to go wide, right? Like their trade route's turn. And you'll need that little econ push to kind of go over. very large shadow could potentially do it. The bigger downside is the card slot. And I don't think the deck is quite there yet. I think it's inching toward it. The biggest problem with these type of decks, all these Kingdom of Shadow decks, is that Greyjoy is so prevalent. And We Do Not Sow is a busted card that should have been restricted a long time ago. And they have enough location destruction as it is. So it kind of keeps threatening these decks that really need this core location to really function. And they can't afford to be HOD because they need the benefit of the Shadow Agenda to exist. And it really hinders their existence. So it's doing a pretty good disservice to the wideness of the game and a deck that this kind of card would shine in. But I do think the deck might exist, but I think you will have to take a negative matchup to Greyjoy if you play that deck. As far as Tyrion, I think you guys are underestimating the opportunity cost of using the core Tyrion gold in challenge-based Shadows deck. The ability is super strong, but Shadows wants money in the challenge phase. Being able to get 4 gold a challenges phase for a Shadows deck is so strong. I think that opportunity cost might be too much to pass up. So I'm skeptical of this Tyrion. I do think the ability is quite strong, and if he wasn't named Tyrion, certainly be in every Lannister Shadows deck, but Tyrion, I think, pulls him down to only some of the Lannister Shadows decks, and then you're going to be surrounded with your plotting goal curve in order to make up the loss of Tyrion. So I still think he's good. He's probably like a B minus, and a very large shadow is probably like a C minus right now. So I think Lanny's like a C. I guess that brings us to Greyjoy, the aforementioned love of my life.
Your favorite faction, Scott.
No comment. I've actually been playing the most Greyjoy lately, but I try to make it more fun. So, first off, we have a 2-cost character, Maester Kerwin, unique, Maester traded, power icon, 1 strength, and he has the interrupt. Whenever another character will be killed, kill Maester Kerwin to save that character. And we have a 2-cost non-loyal event, the Bloody Cup. It's a song. Reaction, after you win an unopposed challenge, choose a character controlled by the losing opponent and place it on top of the owner's deck. So both these effects are clearly very strong, as if saves weren't prevalent enough in Greyjoy and the allure of an offensive valor weren't prevalent enough. We have more. I think Maester Kerwin's a 1F in every Greyjoy deck you play in the future until the end of the game. And the Bloody Cup, it's a very strong ability. I think if Greyjoy Sea of Blood wasn't so strongly affected by the prevalence of Vince being restricted, it'd be everywhere, right? And I think this honestly might bring back Sea of Blood to a smaller extent. I don't think it'll just be every Greyjoy deck a Sea of Blood, right? But it can be one of the predominant builds of the Greyjoy big guy aggro. The ability to put something on top of its opponent's deck gets around the We Do Not Sows and Iron Mines, and now Maester Kerwins of the world that you'll be seeing with Greyjoy being the most prevalent faction in the game. It's just super strong. You're going to get unopposed in Greyjoy. The thing it comes down to is plot slots, right? As we were just talking about before, We Do Not Sows are getting cut in Greyjoy decks. So it's finding the room, but both these cards are extremely strong, and I think I'd give Greyjoy an A for the pack.
Scott, we've known each other for about 4 years now, and this is the most disappointed I've ever been in you, because why did you not immediately say that the Bloody Cup is the most Night's Watch Kraken card that has ever been printed? We just saw Bound for the Wall, which, if you want to be able to steal your opponent's Asha, Bloody Cup's a great, like, four gold? Like, I mean, that's a lot, but if that's what you're building your deck synergies around, it's definitely something that you're going to be able to do. I think, to me, I agree with Scott in the sense of this. Greyjoy is an amazing faction. Maester Kerwin is a boring, good stuff card. I think it goes in every Greyjoy mid-range deck or rush deck. I don't think it necessarily goes in, like, Drown God, but because just, like, Drown God has other better cards to play. But I think it goes in almost every other Greyjoy deck, particularly any mid-range or rush deck. The Bloody Cup is an interesting card in that sense. I don't think it pushes Greyjoy towards towards Sea of Blood. I still think Vince being restricted just immediately says, like, why would I play Sea of Blood? Like, you're giving up, like, literally the reason to play Greyjoy. Like, Greyjoy is extremely beat up. Like, anyone who's played against Greyjoy recently, and I played against a lot of Greyjoy, like, Greyjoy is very beatable until they see a Vince. And and playing a Greyjoy deck without Vince in this current meta, particularly in the Shadows meta, in a meta that is saturated with Baratheon and its character-based triggers, screw it. Sea of Blood can't compete. I think Bloody Cup goes in a variety of attrition decks, and Night's Watch Kraken is one of them. Night's Watch Kraken has always wanted to be really good. It's something we tested for JND2, and it was almost there. I think Bloody Cup pushes it over, particularly with Bound for the Wall. And I think that that's where you're going to see it. I think you're going to see it in a lot of Banner Kraken decks. And it's a really powerful non-loyal removal card. You don't often get those. It's really, yeah. Like, this, again, just shows you in this cycle that Danny is pushing into design space that he's been scared of before. I definitely agree that these are A cards for Greyjoy. But I think that this is more of an A. It's more of an A card for Maester Kerwin is an A card for Mono Greyjoy or Greyjoy main house. Although Maester Kerwin is non-loyal, by the way, and it's any character.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Keep that in mind. So really, these are really, it's an A for Banner Kraken here. And because one of Banner Kraken's problems since Iron Mines got restricted is finding the 12 Banner Kraken cards you want to play. And
there's four right here.
Maester Kerwin provides new. Yeah, there's four right here. So anyway, go ahead, Will, Scott.
You know, I don't know that I have too much to add on these particular cards at this point. I mean, Kerwin's just one of those 1x, why would you not ever sort of cards. And the Bloody Cup, I suppose the biggest thing to say is just my kind of amazement that this type of removal card is non-loyal. It's just almost feels weird to me, like it was almost a goof compared to other similar types of removal. And the one Lannister just got recent-ish is definitely loyal, right? Earlier this cycle, can't for the life of me think of the name of the card now.
Hands of Gold.
Yeah,
it is definitely loyal.
I don't know. I'm very surprised by that. I'm honestly not quite sure what to make of my feelings on whether that type of thing is design space that I want to see explored as far as strong non-loyal removal. I almost feel that is more the sort of thing that should be loyal to force certain house picks for certain themes, but oh well. Regardless, I think these are very good cards for Greyjoy, so I'm on board with the A train.
Are we back around to me now?
Yeah, I think we are.
All right. Well, I at least get to read one really strong card. So we got Covert Loyalist, who in the art is living Danny's dream and sewing dragons secretly. Anyway, this is a 4-cost Shadows card. Military, intrigue, 4-strength, non-loyal, ally, Shadow 4. Action, discard a Targaryen card with printed cost 4 or higher from your hand to put Covert Loyalist into play from Shadows. And one, Music of Dragons, challenges action. Search your deck for a dragon character, reveal it, and add it to your hand. Shuffle your deck. So Comfort Loyalist is actually pretty interesting. Musical Dragon, I think, is also a song. Did I say it was? No, it's not actually a song, which is weird.
Yeah, very odd.
But anyway, Covert Loyalist, I actually think is pretty strong. Printing cost 4 or higher is a legitimate cost. You know, obviously that turns off synergies with Flea Bottom and other things like that. But like, you know, discarding a Covert Loyalist to or Missandei, that's the other major one. But discarding a Covert Loyalist to get another Covert Loyalist is fine. Like, I think that in a Targaryen Shadows build, this is a card that you'll definitely see. It's a C minus card to me. Music of Dragons, I'm really interested to see what my co-hosts, have to say about it, because these specific tutor cards have traditionally been underwhelming. When we think about the Direwolf version of this, that's free. Doesn't even cost a gold. It does, of course, kneel your faction card, so you can't use multiples of them, but it is free. Has never seen much play. But the question is Drogon strong enough, basically? And are the dragons strong enough to make Music of Dragons a playable card? To basically be running three additional copies of all of your dragons with a +1 gold raising. So Drogon becomes a 7 gold card, Viserion becomes a 3 gold card, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe not, but we don't know what Dany's dragons in the upcoming Targ box, how good or bad they are. So if those dragons end up being busted, or at least one of them becomes up being busted, and you have two truly busted dragons, where you have the big Drogon plus this new dragon, then maybe these are worth playing. But for me, I'd say Targaryen is in like a C+ range. Maybe, yeah, a C+.
I think they're probably a straight C. I think the biggest thing in Thrones is the opportunity cost of an event is that much higher because you can't set them up. If Music of Dragons had Shadows, I think it'd be a good playable card. The fact that it doesn't have Shadows and you can't set it up makes it quite a bit worse. So I think your deck really has to want it. Maybe if you're playing a build to Dany, like the core Dany, and you want have like 1x each of the little hatchlings and 3 Drogon and 2 of this or something, then it might make sense. The Covert Loyalist, I think, is relatively efficient. There's enough synergies with the discard, but there are with the smaller things, and there's so much discard that it's good, but it's not great. I don't think it is a card disadvantage. If you're playing Marine, you play this. If you're not playing Marine, I don't think you play this. I think that's basically what it comes down to. So I think that makes this a C- pack.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm willing to go C to C+ on the Targ cards here. I'm not very enthused with the Loyalist personally, since you've got that cost 4 or higher restriction, which really means you have to chuck potent stuff to get it in play, and you're spending money to put it in Shadows to begin with. So I think while it's in a vaguely similar vein as something like Kotho, it's just vastly more expensive in a way that negates a lot of the flexible surprise factor there. Music of Dragons I'm more excited about, mainly to go get 6-cost Drogon. You know, is there some kind of aggro deck that wants to do that regularly? I don't know yet, but I at least like the idea. So,
well, one thing I didn't make clear in my review is it is a challenges action, which is again another knock against it. Again, comparing it to the Direwolf event, you have to. So you say this is in your opening hand. So say it's not even in your setup hand. Say you draw into it. You have to go through a whole challenges phase with
Marshall
before you can you know, a full round for before you can marshal, right? And that means that either Music of Dragons or Drogon or whatever the dragon you want has to make it out of your hand.
Have ambush,
as well.
If you're getting
Drogon would have ambush.
Not fine.
The big ones have ambush, but that means that's true. I guess in that burn deck, like Knights of the Hollow Hill, that was, you know, was opening Fallen from Favor and trying to ambush Drogon in on the first turn. Music of Dragons goes in that deck because you play one gold, boom, ambush them. But like, I don't know.
I just think
you lose to a hand's judgment, don't you? Like, if that's your plan, like if you're sitting there and your opponent goes sit on seven gold, my target opponent goes sit on seven gold, I'm like, oh man, I hope I have a hand's judgment. Like, I just feel that game plan is bad. Well, not bad. It's just, like, not as efficient as it could be.
I mean, it's not the goal game plan, but I think the biggest thing is this just missed by not having shadows. If this had shadows, it'd probably be pretty playable and potentially even a good card. Because then you could set it up, and since it is a challenges action, you could wait till the end of challenges if you're doing the build the Danny or whatever you wanted, so it wouldn't get hit by intrigue claim whatever dragon you fetched.
To be fair, though, it is good with the box Danny, right? She was spoiled. She won't catch me, I thought she lets you just put a card into play. Let me.
Yeah, but isn't there a cost restriction on what she puts?
I'm checking. I'm checking. Search the top 10. Oh, you search the top 10 cards of your deck. Never mind. It has no synergy. Okay. I wasn't quite sure. She's an action. Search the top 10 cards of your deck for an attachment or dragon card. Reveal it. Add it to your hand. You may put it into play if it's 3 cost or lower. Shuffle your deck.
Yeah.
So I thought it was an action. Put like a dragon card into play. But no. It's different. It's different.
Yeah, she's quite good in the Build a Danny sense that I was... as I mentioned, but not the same build as Danny. I also don't know how Nedley it is that you need to, like, the main mechanic for Danny's, besides the unburnt, which is very Nedley, is you must build a Danny.
I think that's actually pretty Nedley, right? Because Danny has our most, well, how spoiler do we want to be towards the show?
we're saying this is the card game.
Consider that a warning.
All right, I'll consider that a spoiler warning, but I'll be relatively vague. Let's just say that Danny has her most success as a character when surrounded by others. Like, once her supporting cast starts getting thinned out, the people she relies on betray her or die, she's less effective. Is that so I actually think it is relatively Nedley.
Okay, maybe that's true.
Anyway, we can save that discussion for props and slops, which no one listens to anyway. We want. But Scotty, sorry, Will, I know you're the boss, but we promised Scott Martell.
Sure.
So.
No, it's fine. Martell's bad this pack anyway.
All right, you don't want him?
I'll do it. I don't care. So we have a 5-cost character, unique, 5-strength, military power icons, Dagos Manwoody, House Manwoody, and Lord Treated. While there are 5 or more different traits among plot cards in your use pile, Dagos Manwoody gains renown and stealth. He's non-loyal. And then we have a non-loyal attachment, 3-cost, item traded. Attached character gets +2 strength and gains renown. Reaction. After an opponent's character with predicted strength 6 or higher is killed, put the Mountain Skull into play from your hand to the discard pile. These are both pretty bad. 5 or more different traits among plot cards in your use pile. I mean, I guess that'll happen sometimes, but you're going along and the reward isn't quite worth it. And that's also assuming he's a sticky character, which is something Martell doesn't usually want. And in that same vein, getting benefits off the renown for the attachment, you're most likely not going to have a sticky character, and it isn't going to be a base big build around character, most likely in Martell. So you probably don't want that. +2 strength is nice, but not at 3 cost. And the reaction is cute, but you're really going to trigger it, and you cannot depend on that. This is a D plus pack for.
I think. Oh, go ahead, Will.
Oh, no, no. You can go ahead. I had not even opened my mouth to say anything.
Ah, well, I think I agree with Scott when it comes to Dago Spanwoody. I think the Martell already has a bunch of good five cost characters it doesn't play consistently. And this one, while being not loyal, and I think five different traits probably isn't that difficult because there are some like weird traits on plots.
It still means probably I about think, turn three at the earliest, right?
Yeah, turn three, but I mean that fits the Martell themes, right?
Yeah, I mean that's fine. Then you're getting a 5 for 5
renowned spell icon,
which is good, but it's not like this dramatic.
Right, but
and it also is
wouldn't you rather play any of the though. Right, and then wouldn't you want to play the any of the Dark Stars over this, right? Or Arianes? Like there are Martell decks that don't play Arianes right now, right? Which is easily one of the best 5-cost characters ever printed. And he, look, we can say a lot of things about Mr. Manwoody and being a wonderful Martin style joke, just like the Long Lances. But
No. Dagos is, I didn't think was the joke. I thought that was Dickon.
Yeah, but I mean, Manwoody being the name of a house is just a joke in and of itself, right? Like, anyway, Martin just being bored and can't come up with house names anymore. He's like, oh, okay, Manwoody. And then we get Dickon Manwoody, which is just calling attention to the joke even more, Martin. But anyway, like, again, there are better 5-drop. There's the Bastard, right? The one that lets you has renown and lets you remove to reduce events.
God's
none
great.
Of these cards see play. Obara, like, none of them see play. Like, Nymeria doesn't always see play. Like, again, Martell's 5-drop slot is full of amazing cards. Dagos is
and
definitely
with this, you're in a round. Do you want to play 5-drops that you're just going to give away?
or Sir Robert Strong, like Sir Robert Strong laughs. It's like, oh, this is super cute, which is really funny with the Mountain Skull. So the Mountain Skull, I think, actually will see some play in Martell cohort. Because the +2 strength of Renown gives a little bit of acceleration to that deck, which, like, Martell Cohort is actually a really good deck. It actually would be pretty good in this meta. Its problem is that it's so slow. It is easily one of the slowest decks out there. It makes a Tyrell Shadows deck that, like, inches forward and gets 3 power after 75 minutes seem like it's, like, that deck is on the treadmill. And is just like speeding ahead. This card provides a acceleration for that Martell deck. Plus, it provides a card that just can start any of your cohort trains that you need. And you will occasionally get it to come back. So I think the fact that it's a marginal attachment with upside means it will be a one of in cohort. Which probably puts it at like a C-, and Dagos Manwoody is like a D-. So this is probably a D-plus pack for Martell. Maybe a C- if we're being super generous, but I think it's definitely D- C+. Or D-plus C-. Excuse me.
Well, I don't know. I'm just not particularly enthused about either of these, as earlier comments might have attested to. I feel like this is kind of one of the more awkward of these 5-drops that maybe turn on and get you some extra power or renown or something. I really feel like a card that's going to dictate both my plot choices in deck construction and my plot choices in gameplay really needs a much stronger upside than Dagos. And if I'm just playing him as kind of an incidental, hope he gets there kind of thing, there's a million other cards to play over him. The Mountain Skull is iffy. There's shades of some magic cards, some mantles, I think, that I kind of like. You can do some fun things in Popper, so I'm hoping this is Danny's nod to those sort of decks. So, I mean, it's fine. It's not exciting. Cheating it in might have a little home somewhere, but overall, I think Martell probably gets like a D plus out of this. I'm not enthused.
Okay. So this next card is yours, Will.
Oh yeah, I forgot because I flip flopped with Scott. Already forgot. We have our first neutral card. This is Sparrows. 2 cost, 2 strength, power icon, the 7 trait, shadow 2, and reaction after Sparrows comes out of shadows. Move 1 power from an opponent's faction card to another, the 7th card you control. I mean, living the dream here is playing Lannister with Tyrion and Bowels and 2 of these in shadows, right? And you just, well, I guess, and another 7 card in play. There you go. And then you can just chain them every phase, bring 1 out to get a couple gold and have Tyrion send the other back into shadows and then repeat it the next phase. So, I mean, there's a Shaga part of me that loves that. and it might maybe help with a stealthy win here and there in, like, general play. I don't know that it's that great. I'm not quite sure it has the oomph once it's in play to really be there for Faith Militant decks. But the Shaga jank potential here I love. So it's probably like a C. I'll give it a
Scott, you're our resident Faith Militant expert here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's something I need to play around with. I think it might be decent in Barra Faith Militant with a Shadow sub theme. So this is where you would actually potentially use the Rush, Blackwater Rush that we talked about earlier, and you're using prison cells to keep things knelt that are bigger threats, and you just have little guys on the board constantly kind of resetting them and using either Mel or Prison to the bigger threat that they can keep it down. That might be good there, or it might be trying to do too much, and I'm not sure yet. Either way, it's leading off the other cards more so than itself, but it's still strong. You can't get power on your house, then chances are you're not going to win. So I think that there is some potential there, but a 2-for-2 power when you straight play it, and it's still just another power icon, is also a downside there, right? So I think it might be like a C+ to B-. It might just be doing more of what the deck wants, but it might just be overkill. It gets it there, but it is adding some extra oomph to play the cells. As I mentioned, I think that is much stronger than the Rush.
I mean, this was discussed earlier with some friends of mine. This card continues to rejuvenate the Tyrell Faith Dream. Because what's interesting is Tyrell has a bunch of random the 7 cards. The number one random the 7 card that they have is Gates of the Gods, the Tyrell economy card, is a 7 card. So you can put this on your economy card, and it being a limited location makes it much safer from location hate than other locations, right? The only thing that can hit it, I think, is Night, like consistently hit it, is either We Do Not Sow or a Night Flare, right? And there's a bunch of random 7 characters that exist in Tyrell. So like on the Shaga jank side of me, that the like I like honest to goodness, Wama and I spent some time this week, or last week actually, talking about Tyrell Faith. Like, I would love to play that deck. And is a great card for Unexpected Guile on like a trade routes turn where your opponent's at like five power and you're like, okay, challenge, return it. There's just things that it can do. It provides an additional redundancy for playable seven characters, which if you go into Card Game DB or Thrones DB and you put the seven trait in, there's a remarkably few number of characters with the seven trait. And this is just another one, and it's one that does something that furthers the seven game plan. So I'm going to give this a C minus. And I hope in many ways that it breaks open the seven archetype, like, because it's been threatening constantly to be good outside of melee, because I do think it is a very solid melee option. Also, remember, this also goes on Fat Cat. So if you want to build a Stark Faith deck around Fat Cat, playing your sweet Rue Montgomery alt art Fat Cats, you definitely can do that. So again, I think this is definitely a Shaga card, but it's actually very close to being a Jamie card as well. So
I believe it's up to you, Roy, for the next card.
Oh, will you review the card?
Yeah, sure enough.
Okay. All right. So the White Cloak is a one gold item attachment knight character you control only. Attached character gains the King's Guard trait interrupt when a king or queen character would be killed. Kneel attached character to save. Okay. This card is an F played, honestly. And if you are ever playing against someone and they just marshal this on just a random knight, you're like, oh, sweet, I'm going to win this game. This card is bad played honestly. However, played extremely dishonestly and degenerately, this card is good. It is a combo card is what this is. You can put it on. You can give Renly, for example, the big seven cost Renly, the knight trait, through knighted or some other way. And he can kneel to save himself. Okay. Which gets really cute when you're playing a combo deck that has stacked cards, like stacked power on him or stacked attachments on him or all kinds of stuff. You can also do it on other cards that get the king trait. I think that this is a combo enabler. Other than that, is an F card. So it is an E card. It's a soft E. It's an E minus card. It's primarily an F, but there's a lot of really dumb shit you can do with this card if you're playing it dishonestly. But if you're ever trying to like really, really play it like as a fair card, you shouldn't, even in cohort, unless you're trying to abuse the interaction. So
yeah, I was gonna say Bower Rose cohort is the deck that first came to mind for me with this, which was the deck that went around for a bit.
But there's better one cost attachments that deck could be playing.
Man,
like this card, except for the save, does nothing in that deck, right? It doesn't provide at least knighted provides one plus one strength, right?
It's to save your mob, because that deck's a Bob deck.
It is and it isn't. Like it can win without Bob. It can win with Randall. It can win with other things.
I mean, I don't think this is good. I think in that deck you probably run one of it. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I haven't played that deck in a long time, and maybe it is worth in some combo, but that probably isn't tier one. I don't know. It's probably a C minus because I do think Bower Rose cohort, and maybe there's another build now like that might want this. I think there might be enough in Bower to want this as a 1x if you have a cohort. Will?
Will?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm having trouble getting enthused about the White Cloak. I mean, I suppose it is kind of exactly what you would expect in kind of the most bare bones Nedley sort of sense. I mean, and it's just not that exciting when played straight, as Roy was saying. So I'm not as enthused about that as I suppose I could be.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
well,
that's
true.
Top
that's true.
Five worst cards, I mean, printed, right?
He's talking about the most Nedley of Nedley attachments.
But it is Nedley. Yeah, it does feel weird to me that I've come to a place where I'm looking at a card and saying, yeah, that's really Nedley.
But it doesn't even provide plus one strength.
Exciting.
Like, if it was super Nedley, like being a member of the King's Guard, the King's Seven, right, is one of the biggest honors. It doesn't give renown. It does literally...
Or renown. I think renown would be perfect. There's only seven. You're super famous if you get named to the Kingsguard. And now there's a cool dynamic about, do you make a challenge and get renown with them, or save them to kneel and save the King?
It's clearly designed.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Otherwise,
it'd be too good.
I mean, I agree. It should also only be on unique knights, right? Like, again... I mean, it's clearly designed to enable the next terrible card that I think Will should read over over Scott.
That too.
Yes, you picked the name for the podcast, Will. And it's clearly designed to enable that and make the spoiler alert deck more consistent. But it's mostly garbage. I do think you will see it in combo decks as a one of, like, emergency kind of like BS card, but remember the number of terrible cards that combo decks run in Thrones. But go ahead, Will.
Okay, here we go. The White Book. You may include non-loyal Kingsguarded characters from any faction in your deck. You must include at least seven different Kingsguard characters. Reaction: after you win a challenge, kneel your faction card to stand each defending Kingsguard character you control, each participating Kingsguard character you control instead, if you control a king or queen character. So I admit I did mean to have a search pulled up beforehand, and I completely goofed. How many total Kingsguard?
Unique by name, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 by name.
Okay. So you can make a few choices. I was thinking
playably. There's the Save Barristan. Baelon Swan, who gives you gold when a non-Lannister knight. Okay. Mandon Moore, of course, has been good. Sir Meron Trant isn't even out yet. Sir Osmond Kettleback? Okay, he's acceptable. We just saw Sir Preston Greenfield. He's kind of bad. Sir Robert Strong? Okay. The Hound? So there's like a light Shadows theme, because there's 1, 2, 3 Shadows.
Yeah. A light Shadows theme, and the only one that actually cares that the other ones have
is Knight of
Shadows
Flowers.
Is the Knight
and
of Flowers.
And to be fair, Knight of Flowers is busted. And you, like, he is busted if you can get the Shadows thing going.
He seems real strong, but the rest of stuff is so weird and disconnected. And you mentioned Balin Swan, for instance, who gets you some gold after a non-Lannister Night Enders play. Which Enders play is nice. It could work nicely with the Shadows. But out of those 11 Kingsguard, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 out of those 11 are all Lannister. So that's not a good ratio here if you're looking at making Kingsguard the thing. Now you've got to be picking a non-Lannister house, heavy in knights, probably Tyrell then at that point, to be able to trigger Balin. And I just I don't know. Their abilities are all over the place. Okart discards an ally, which has never been good.
For 2 gold. Whoa.
Swan,
whoa.
We were just talking about.
It would be fine if you didn't have to pay 2 gold.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I would agree with that.
So I think Okart has always been fine, but it's always just been super replaceable, right? Like, you could always just put something else in its place, and it'd probably be better. But he's always been fine. I don't think Okart's bad. Not that the Shimeki plays it or anything, but he's not bad. He's better than a lot of these other choices.
Also, by the way,
he's not actively bad. Overshadowed.
According to Thrones DP, there's literally, because it says non-loyal, right? No, kings are non-loyal. Yeah, literally, they're all non-loyal. By the way, like they're like all the all the kings guard characters are non-loyal. The problem is, I mean, there's so many problems with this agenda. Like, none of the King's Guard characters are good enough on their own for you to want them. They don't synergize with each other well enough.
That's the killer. Like, almost nothing actually synergizes or interacts with any of the other Kingsguard.
I mean,
so, like, why do I want to build a whole deck around Kingsguard when Kingsguard have no identity?
I mean, even if Danny had done what Nate did with the Kingsguard in that Shadow Cycle in First Edition, where they printed 7, 6, 5, 4, even more than just the 2, I think it's just Knight of Flowers, Suppressing Goofield. So there's 3, excuse me. So more of them that were all shadows. So say there were 7 shadows Kingsguard characters in this cycle. That would at least create a sub theme that you could then supplement those Kingsguard characters with Shadows tech. And you could use, say, for example, Knight of Flowers, who, just for anybody who doesn't know, he has Shadow 5 Renown reaction. After a card comes out of Shadows, choose and stand a Kingsguard character, limit twice per round. Like Knight of Flowers, like, kind of like, he's super good in just a Shadows deck. Don't get me wrong. You should put him in your Shadows deck. But he would be specifically good in this White Book deck if there were a really good critical mass of Shadows Kingsguard characters. So maybe Knight of Flowers signals that you should run White Book plus Shadows, but then you're stuck with whatever your faction's mono Shadows cards are. And one of the things we found is that maybe Tyrell is the only faction with good enough mono Shadows cards to really be competitively playable, particularly without the Assault agenda. But again, we've not seen any mono faction so that means non-Kingdom of Shadows, non-Assault Shadows decks. So that's kind of an open question. My theory would be it would be Tyrell is kind of the best. But that's like really stretching it. So this is definitely an F agenda, and it breaks my heart. But it's an F.
Yeah, it really kills me that the titular agenda here for our show is just bad. I mean, I'm not saying that they couldn't print more Kingsguard in the future, new versions of stuff that would make this agenda playable to good. But not with the pool we have right now.
It'd need a lot. They definitely need to put Intimidate on a lot. That's the only way all this stand becomes worth it, is if you Intimidate.
But, I mean, it's right only, now, of course, it's... But, of course, it's only defending unless you control a king or queen.
You can make someone a king easy enough in this game. There's enough attachments.
That's fair, but then you're running these attachments. I don't know. Like, I think you're stuck. If you really want to abuse the agenda, you're stuck with a faction with good native kings or queens. So that means what? Tyrell and Barra?
Lanny has Big Cersei.
Oh, that's true. Both Cerseis, right? Both 6 and 7 are queens. So there you go. There's a Shadows theme for Lannister.
Baelon.
True.
Oh, but yeah.
But then like, where are you getting the knights to support?
I'm not saying this
Fox Jamie
good, but like Greyjoy also has just the knight.
There we go.
You're right.
And he could benefit from that intrigue icon. There you go.
That's true. He could definitely benefit from that intrigue. But he's Kingsguard. He's not a Kingsguard. It's Sir Jaime Lannister.
Oh, dang it. You're right.
It's each knight character you control gains for now while attacking alone.
You have to give him a white cloak.
Oh my god. All right, we gotta get on. I'm gonna be the glazer. We gotta stop talking about bad cards.
It's enough.
Yeah. Like, that's fair.
So Scott, bring us home to a good card.
This might be the best card in the pack. It's the card that makes me the happiest in the pack. It's a plot. King's Landing Riot, 3-1-1. City traded, 6 reserve. Force interrupt. When the challenges phase ends, if there are 3 or more city plots in your used pile, discard each character from play. If reset is coming and Valor is resetting, this becomes the only true reset of resets in the game. We are seeing so many city plots already being played at the gates. It's probably the biggest opener in the game. I don't know the stats in front of me, but it's probably the most common one. And then...
what are your other 2 cities, though, in your control deck, Scott?
Well, your other 3 cities. You got to... No, or, oh, sorry,
out the
2
gates
plus
one.
Out the gates.
2. Yeah. What are your other 2? That's the question I have about this card. So what are your other 2 cities in your control, or even mid-rangey into control deck?
Let me pull up all the city-traded things. I didn't have this ready because I had the Kingsguard up. But let's see. So I think Spiders is probably fine if you want to get more land. A City Besieged, actually, I think, is a good card, especially in a control-y type of deck. And then you're probably running Secrets at that point. So that's what makes it difficult.
Whoa. You're running Secrets? Where each player draws 2 cards and then each player without a city plot discards 2? You're not running Secrets.
You might if you just want to get this off the ground.
So it more sounds like to me what you're running is you're going at the gates, into City Besieged, into City of Spiders, into King's Landing Riot.
I don't think you have to do it in that way. That's probably the most likely way you're going to do it. But...
because, like, usually, what? At the gates makes City Besieged, like, a 4 gold plot? Plus whatever economy you drew or set up? And then, so, you've got a 4 gold, 2 claim plot that also kneels 2 of your opponent's locations? And has 8 initiative. I mean, that's not horrible. And then you're going, you know, City of Secrets to either kneel or gain economy. Or City of Spiders, rather.
Yeah.
Either kneeling or gain economy.
You are. I think City of Secrets can be fine if you are, depending on the deck, right? Like, if you're playing more trial with a lot of icon stripping, then I actually think City of Secrets is good because you can choose the icon stripping type of character or attachments or whatever you want, or if you need to find a flea bottom, which is perfectly fine in that deck. I think that's fine. But if you aren't that piece intensive and you're just good stuff, then I think you probably just want more econ. That's something that those type of decks will need. Or you're kneeling your opponent's econ and choking them out a bit.
So you're probably running 4 city plots, right, in this deck? So maybe 5, right? So you're running at the gates, at least 1 city besieged, at least city of spiders, a King's Landing Riot, and probably a 2nd at the gates, right? Because sometimes you're going to want to go at the gates, city besieged, you're reset, right?
I'm not sure if you're on the second at the gates. I don't think.
Excuse me, at the gates. I mean, a city besieged. You probably a city besieged is what you run two of, right?
I think it depends on the deck. I think you're right. I think you probably want to run a Valor in this type of deck still.
But then, you mentioning bringing in Valor there makes me just think about the thing that frustrates me the most or worries me about this is that turn four is the earliest it can be played. And having to have that delay is, I think, pretty rough of a dictation there. And then even if you include Valor, then you reveal that earlier. Now you've pushed further back when you're able to play this.
I definitely should have said Valor D, not Valor M. I think you need Valor
both
D.
Pushing this back since they're not cities, though.
I mean, I suppose that it pushes you back a bit, but this is more making your opponent have nothing, this type of deck, than you have things. I think that's the difference, maybe. I don't know if this is like how good this will be. I want it to be good, obviously, because if Valor M rotates and we don't have anything that truly wipes the board, this is our only chance, right? And I think we learned from 1.0, I didn't play it, but that type of effect is very necessary for the game.
I mean, we've learned in second edition, though, that Valor Margulis, as much as many players hate it,
I would agree,
is necessary for the game.
So if you take away Valor Margulis, this is the next best thing we have. And if this doesn't work, then I don't think the game can work. I honestly think with the amount of saves we printed, it makes the game not work as well as it should anyway. But that's another topic that we've discussed ad nauseum.
I think what makes this different, right, is there's not a lot of non-dupe saves that save from discard, right?
Bodyguard
is one of them. But Bodyguard, of course, generally right now is not seeing it play outside of cohort X, right? And maybe this card does. Maybe this encourages people to play Bodyguards. But then, of course, they're playing a fine card. But oftentimes we're at the point now with the card pool that just running Bodyguard in your mid-range deck is not a good idea. Like, you have 61 other cards you'd rather be playing than Bodyguards. Outside of cohort, of course. So I think that's actually a good adaptation of the meta, right? I think the biggest problem...
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I think the biggest problem that Cities has right now, we still have, what, two more
one
packs?
One more this cycle?
Or is it one more pack?
Yeah.
One more this cycle. So there's only one more opportunity for Dane to pick a card advantage city plot. City of Secrets is garbage. The draw two, discard two. As I said in the review, I thought that the best chance it had would be in a combo deck. That has not proven to be the case. I think it's just garbage. If he prints some kind of card advantage city, then I think that this is in a good chance, because that lets you go something like open at the gates into a card advantage plot, into a two claim plot, into this reset. So the two claim plot clears off the dupes and then you reset them.
Do March after the chance of them having two duped characters is relatively light.
That's fair. Particularly if you have a city besieged somewhere in that plot lineup, right? Yeah. Leading into the riot. So, I mean, manning the city walls is also an option. You just have to be running enough non-unique characters to make it worth it, right?
I mean, the type of deck that wants this isn't depending too much on having unique characters, because that'd hurt them if they're in this type of game plan that they lead up to a board.
Unless they're, I don't know, unique Shadows characters. I mean, there are definitely situations I would let my Robert Strong or what have you go so that I can bring a new one out.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
I mean, definitely, I think that King's Landing Riot plays well with Shadows in the way that Will said. Like, a lot of the Shadows cards, you don't necessarily mind them being discarded. You know, you got the value out of them. You used your, Cat Spa to pop a dupe off the key character. So your King's Landing Riot clears them. And, oh, okay, your Cat Spa got discarded. Who cares about that, right? I think that the problem that Shadows and King's Riot, Landing Riot has is that I don't think Shadows, the fact that the best non-at-the-gates Shadows card is 2 gold is what's so killing.
They don't really want any of the others either.
I don't think Shadows can be besieged, which is really good, but I don't think Shadows can afford it.
Yeah, I mean, City Besieged, as Wama showed with his UK Nats winning deck, is very powerful, but it just the high gold, the thirstiness of the Shadows build. So I just think that the main problem, and I really do think King's Landing is an A card, King's Landing Riot, excuse me, is an A card, maybe an A minus at worst. I think the problem is it was clear the Shadows cards were clearly printed with this card in mind, and I'm not sure if Danny. I think Danny was too cautious. He was afraid of us living in a King's Landing Riot meta, because he was afraid basically of, you know, there being two, you know, you go at the gates, a decent card, a City Besieged, King's Landing Riot, copy King's Landing Riot. That's what they were afraid of. They were afraid of that play pattern, and I think that led to the City plotline getting over-nerfed when it comes to this plot.
How would you copy King's Landing Riot?
Can you do that?
With, yeah. City of Spiders, right?
You can't. No, because King's Landing Riot is a force interrupt at the end of challenges.
Okay.
And gotcha. City of Spiders just copies it with yield.
Oh, you're right. You're right. So,
which then even more limits City of Spiders, like, application in a full, like, city list. Oof. I mean, really, Besieged or maybe Manning is all I'm really wanting? I don't know. City... Sure.
And whatever the
city
plot
city plots
at least
definitely
one
do
more,
not
right?
gel as well this time around as I would have hoped for. So... Yeah. I didn't necessarily expect them to be on that level of par this time around, but I didn't expect something quite so fractured this time. So, well. Anything else for the pack as a whole, guys? Oh yeah, there's several very, very tasty cards here. I think it's a very interesting penultimate choice. All right, does that send us to some props and slops then? All right, man, Scott spoke up there. It's almost like he has something this week.
I'll slop that.
Touche.
Will.
have I?
You know, I don't.
Have
think
I been
so.
On the show since Fire Emblem Three Houses came out? Okay, well, I will definitely prop Fire Emblem Three Houses. I have beaten it through one faction. I'm currently about half to two-thirds of the way through a second playthrough. It's fantastic. If you own a Switch, you should definitely purchase it. Easily one of the best games I've played in the last 5 years, maybe even 10 years. Definitely on a systems level, the best Fire Emblem game since the GameCube games. On a story level, sentimental attachment to me, it's the best since Awakening, because I, unlike some hardcore Fire Emblem fans, I have a soft spot for Fire Emblem Awakening on the 3DS. But it is, honest to goodness, one of the best JRPGs produced in a good long time. So if you want to Switch, buy it.
Nice. Man, one of these days, maybe I'll have time to devote to a JRPG again. That would really be nice.
This one is a little bit more fair with your time. Like, you can come in and out of it. If you, like, you don't have to invest endless amounts of hours like I have, Will.
Okay. I like the sound of that.
I just have a PS4, so I can't play it.
Oh, well.
But you can play the Spider-Man game.
The Spider-Man game is a good game.
It's a fantastic game. It's a really great representation of New York.
You're even headed in the direction I was about to sort of. Because I was going to mention, speaking of time invested, I'm pretty bummed about the time I've invested in the MCU lately due to the Sony-Disney non-deal over Spider-Man. So
slop shit.
To that. Yeah. I'm really kind of worried now about Phase 4 going forward. You know, I was double-checking what films are officially in Phase 4.
So it's Black Widow, Eternals, Black Panther 2. I'm missing. Oh, Shang-Chi, is that
Shang-Chi,
how you say it?
Yeah.
Shang-Chi. Oh, and Thor, Love and Thunder. Those are all the ones. And then the ones that are in development, but they haven't announced dates for, are Blade,
I mean,
Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and Black Panther 2.
But as far as having
a
charismatic lead.
And Captain Marvel, too. They've also said that they're working
to the MCU. It's very obvious they were starting to build Tom Holland's Spider-Man into that direction going forward. And if he is now off the table, I don't know. I mean, Black Widow is also effectively off the table due to the nature of, Endgame, I guess. There may very well,
we don't
be
know
a
whether or not they're going to be replacing her at the end of it. I would assume. I would assume that there will be a character operating in the MCU. I mean, this is, I have not encountered any spoilers or anything, but based on, the only way they would make a Black Widow movie is if there's not a character at the end of that movie identifying as Black Widow operating in the MCU.
Sure. Which, I mean, that's happened before in the comics. Somebody else took over.
I mean, it clearly is happening with Cap and Falcon, right? Like, that was
right.
In that game. So,
but I mean, like, looking at both the characters chosen and or though the actors currently filling them, like, if you look at some of these other ones, I mean, Cumberbatch can be that level of charming, but Strange is definitely not set up to actually fill that type of role. Anthony Mackie, Sebastian Stan, I've never quite gotten that out of them. Hemsworth, I'm very certain, is out after Love and Thunder.
I very much doubt he is. I would almost, particularly after how Men in Black International did, I would bet that Chris Hemsworth will be old Odin Thor before they take him out of the
that. I mean, They may very well transition to that, but if they do that, that also means he's not really available to fulfill that like charismatic heart kind of role. I mean, while I love the character of Captain Marvel, Larson was flat. I'll be honest.
I mean, I think you're being ungenerous. I think whether or not you like Brie Larson, I think a critical mass of Marvel fans liked her enough that she could easily be the face of it as well.
I personally did not get that vibe. Same thing with Black Panther and Chadwick Boseman. Like,
oh.
I mean, I love the movie, but it wasn't for him.
I think, again, I think that's a matter of perspective. Like, I think there are people that aren't you and I will that really appreciated what that character was. And like, and that actor's particular interpretation of like being an African king and this strong African character that was competent and heroic and funny. And I think a lot of people, there are people that really enjoyed that, like that character, whether or not he was like the most original superhero of all time, which he wasn't. He was just, you know, a Superman.
What superhero is.
But like there are some more like that deviate from the type, but he was definitely like the straight man of that movie. But I think there are people who really identified with that specific vision of like the straight man hero.
Well, I've digressed at least in a timeline sense a lot more than I meant to. Suffice it to say that a lot of stuff I personally don't feel like existing casting is set up in a way to take over that. So I feel like that puts a lot of pressure on things like Shang-Chi casting to really nail something there. So I don't know. We'll see how it goes. It's not like I'm not going to watch Marvel movies, but
Where I disagree with you, Will. I agree with you in the sense that I think that losing Tom Holland's Spider-Man, and I think basically the two Spider-Man movies were specifically written and designed to tell Sony, like, you can't take this character back. We're going to tie this version of Spider-Man so much into the MCU that like it like literally makes no sense to pull him out of the MCU. Like,
yep.
Tom Holland's Spider-Man does not work without reference to the other Marvel characters. Like, it was literally like they tried to write Sony creatively into a corner that they couldn't do what ended up happening. But Sony was like, F it, we made a lot of money. Venom made way more money. So what they'll probably do is a Spider-Man versus Venom movie.
Yeah.
Is almost certainly where I think they're going to go. What ended up happening naturally by the time Endgame came around was that people were invested in each different Avenger, like of the big three or four, for different reasons, right? Like Black Widow, people were invested in her because she was the first female Avenger. Scarlett Johansson has a lot of charisma. She was very competent. You had, of course, Tony Stark. He was the founder. He, you know, Iron Man kind of made Marvel Universe work. You know, Chris Evans, Cap's a great character. Chris Evans, like, embodied the character in a really charismatic way. The same is true for Chris Hemsworth. But, like, by the time Endgame happened, there were sort of, like, people who were attracted to these sort of four major characters for different reasons. All of them but Chris Hemsworth are gone now. But I think what Marvel's approach is going to be is have not one temple character the way in which Tony Stark was, because Tony was the OG one. Robert Downey Jr. was really charismatic and, it, you know, was the foundation of the universe. But be like, okay, so we'll have people who really love Doctor Strange, we'll have people who really love Shang-Chi, people who really love Black Panther, people who really love Brie Larson. And then once every 3 or 4 years, we will just bring them all together for an Avengers movie to make an extra ton of money. Where instead they're not asking you to invest in like the story of Tony Stark, like the way in which basically from the first Iron Man movie until Endgame, you could basically view the entire MCU in some sense as being like the story of Tony Stark. Instead of being like, you invest in this character, and if you love this character and their design and their fandom, and then every 2 to 3 years, you come to an Avengers movie.
I mean,
and that they hope that there's enough invested Marvel fans plus people who love the mysticism, people who love the powerful African hero, people who love the powerful feminist hero, people who love the powerful Asian hero, like that they will be able to sort of coast with their hardcore Marvel fans, plus whatever the specific fandom is that they are promoting for that movie.
The trick is with that specific fandom issue that you brought up, that like – they've moved on from a lot of their tier one characters at this point.
That's fair.
Like, let's be honest. Eternals are probably a tier three property. Shang-Chi's probably tier
three. Tier three. Okay.
Sorry. Tier four?
Is definitely tier three. Tier Z. Like, Eternals is terrible. Like, I'm sorry. Like, you can love the Jack Kirby art in original Eternals.
Sure.
That's
sure.
Fine. It's beautiful. But the writing is mostly garbage. The Neil Gaiman series was mostly garbage.
I just actually reread that about a month ago. It was okay.
It's mostly garbage. Mostly garbage. It's like trying to make the most
out
of it. He was handed a pile of shit.
Sure.
And he was trying to sell you like that this shit doesn't smell. But it smells. Like Eternals is like the weirdest thing. I do not know why Marvel has fixated to try to make Eternals work.
I mean, the answer is really simple. It's the internal feud between Marvel Television and Marvel Studios. Marvel Television wound up with the Inhumans, and the Eternals turn out to be a very simple slot in for whatever general arc they had planned there.
Oh, but here's the thing. They should have never built anything around either
That's
of those types of characters.
That's both true. Even the Inhumans are tier two at best.
Suck. Be tier three.
Tier three, yeah. X-Men like, are tier are one. Inhumans are the tier three version of the X-Men.
They're terrible. Anyway, we've definitely lost.
Yeah. We went way into the danger zone here, I'm pretty sure.
But, I would say that I think that Marvel's in a good spot, actually. I mean, their strategy, I think, will actually end up paying dividends. I'm excited, actually, for most of the Marvel movies. Because we have to remember, like, I read Annihilation as it came out. I thought Annihilation was fine. But no one outside of hardcore comics fans cared about Guardians of the Galaxy until that Guardians of the Galaxy
sure.
came out. That shows me that the broader superhero movie fan base is open to these kind of things with the Marvel brand. And you can even see the success of Aquaman as a way of just showing like people who enjoy superhero movies, not including
comic book fans. You're telling me the Eternals is going to be a comedy?
To a variety of... Who knows? Like, we really don't know. Like, who knows, Will? Like, that movie is lip tight. Like, no one knows, like, it's got big stars, Angelina Jolie. Doesn't it have Rob Stark?
Richard Madden. Actually, I think he is playing her love interest, if I remember correctly, who he's cast as.
So, like, it's got some famous people in it. Like, it has, like, one of the biggest actresses of the last 20 sure. years. So, we'll see. Maybe Keanu Reeves. I've also heard that he might be doing that.
Yeah,
so
I hear they keep looking for the right role to get him into. So we'll see what happens.
Anyway, this has definitely brought us into
the danger zone.
The danger zone? We should close a chapter on this.
So
terrible
so
agenda.
Close. Danger zone.
We should close a chapter.